Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real-life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castanini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to today's episode. I'm really excited for anyone out there who is a parent listening, because I get so many questions from parents who, you know what, they ask me all sorts of questions, such as what's the quote unquote best way to feed their children. They ask me questions like which foods they need to avoid or what they need to do or not do or say so their child won't get an eating disorder. And I could go on and on. There's so many questions, and I get it because I'm a parent and we want to know if we're doing the best things for our kids. And I want nothing else than to ease your worries, anxieties, and also give parents helpful and useful information, which is why I'm really looking forward to bringing in our guest today. I'm joined by Heidi Schuster, who is a nutrition and eating disorder specialist with over 30 years of experience helping people heal their relationships with food and body image. She's the author of the acclaimed books, Nourish, How to Heal Your Relationships with Food, Body, and Self, and Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food and Their Bodies and Themselves. She is known for her compassionate and holistic approach, and Heidi shares insights through her newsletter, Nourishing Words, where she combines her professional knowledge with her own personal experiences as a parent and as someone in recovery. In this episode, Heidi will guide us through practical, stress-free strategies for raising kids with a healthy, positive relationship to food without getting caught up in diet culture or worrying endlessly about nutrition. She's going to share her best tips for creating a calm, balanced food environment that lets kids grow up to trust their own bodies and make mindful, self-regulated choices. So whether you're a parent, caregiver, or anyone just curious about a gentler approach to food, this conversation is packed with lots of valuable insights for every stage of a child's development. I'm going to go get Heidi and bring her on.
All right. Well, Heidi, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you here today.
I'm so excited to be here too, Christina. Thank you so much for having me.
So I always ask guests when they come on, how did you get here in your career and your life? I know it's probably a long story, but just in terms of working with the population you do, and obviously you've written two books, which we'll get into, but how did you get here?
Well, it's a really long story, but I'll try to give the Cliff Notes version. I had my own struggle with an eating disorder in my late teens. And went on to college to study nutrition, I think partly because I was doing my own recovery work. And it was actually helpful, believe it or not, because it gave me this perspective that as a young dancer at the time, I actually need to eat more food than I thought. And I appreciated food as fuel more at that time. And it helped me with my recovery to study nutrition, believe it or not. I also fell into learning from some people who are kind of on a track very different than the typical dietitians. Ellen Satter, who you might know, came to speak at my college in the 90s, and she was talking about a different way of thinking about emotions and food and raising kids. And that was really pivotal for me to listen to her speak and to think about our relationship with food and our development around that as being so important. And I ended up studying nutrition and psychology and went on to become a professional and to write about this topic. But I think in a lot of ways, I got sort of derailed from my writer self when I had my eating disorder as a young person. And now I'm sort of coming back as someone, I mean, now in my 50s, but over the last like decade, coming back to the writer inside of me and bringing all the work that I've done in the field into my writing. So I guess that's a good Cliff Notes version for you.
It's interesting. I find that a lot of people in the field have had eating disorders. I think that's been the case with the vast majority of professionals I've had on the podcast. And to that point, a lot of dietitians, nutritionists did go into nutrition studying that because they were in the throes of their eating disorder. And it seemed like it was, oh, I was so interested in food, or maybe they wanted to, I don't know. Were you aware that you had an eating disorder at the time that you went into study nutrition?
Yes, I was. I was in treatment, actually, my own like outpatient counseling for it. And it makes sense that I would have been interested in nutrition because my head was all about food at the time, given my eating disorder. But as I came out of that and I started to understand what the eating disorder was about and that it was so much more than just food, I stayed really interested in, well, how can we help young people to understand more about how to take care of themselves, both with food and also with movement? That was big for me as a young, active person. I just wish I'd had a lot more guidance around food and nutrition as a dancer that just didn't exist at the time. So I stayed in nutrition and psychology because obviously that's where my head was at the time.
So I'm curious, do you think that it's helpful? Do you disclose to people you're working with your history, first of all?
That's a great question. I don't disclose verbally my history much at all. Certainly not in sessions. I don't necessarily make it about me, but pretty much it's pretty hard not to know if you're a client of mine that I have my own history because I write about it, not only in my books and my articles, but it's there on my website. If someone asks me about it, I certainly give them information. If I've worked with a client for a long period of time, I might say to them, I can relate to that because when I was going through my own experience. So I do, like, in little dribs and drabs, talk about my recovery and my own history, although I obviously want to keep my focus on the client who's in front of me. But I do think it's helpful. At first, I was really told not to do that by many people in my professional community. And it just didn't sit right with me. I mean, I think about the addictions field and how many people are addictions counselors and have had their own history. And that's so valuable to the people that they're supporting. So it just didn't sit right to me to not have that be out there and to be more open about it. But I did need to be pretty far along in my recovery before I felt comfortable putting it out there. First, I did it in writing in a blog post at the time, because then I could take any questions or comments about it and be in a place of real solid recovery for me to be able to answer those questions and keep those boundaries. But yeah, I think it's important. I don't know why we aren't more open and why there's some stigma around recovery in our field.
Like, I know for myself, I always thought, gosh, if I would have had somebody say to me during my treatment, hey, I've been there, I understand, I think it would have been very helpful. So I'm just wondering, thinking back to your own treatment, do you think that would have been helpful for you too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would have felt like, oh, there's some validation here. Not only that I'm not alone and strange, but that you can get through this and get to the other side. I absolutely. I've heard that feedback from clients that it's helpful to know that you can get through something and lead a more meaningful life.
That too, because when we're talking about younger people, a lot of times you're working mostly, I think, with the parents, because the parents are the ones buying the food. They're the ones setting more of the food rules in the home. And so I'm actually curious, in your practice, the ages that you work with people and how that looks like. Do you work primarily with the child? Or are you working with the family? How does that work in your practice?
Well, it's morphed over time. When my first bit of work was mainly with adolescents.
Okay.
I finished an adolescent fellowship at Children's Hospital in Boston, and then primarily worked with teens for a long time, both inpatient and then outpatient. And then when I moved into my own practice, I was able to see teens and families a little bit more, a little longer sessions, things like that. But I primarily worked with teens and families. These days, I think what happened is I had my own family, and that just took a certain amount of energy. And so I also didn't want to not be around when my kids came home from school. So I ended up sort of shifting and seeing mostly college students and adults. But definitely my first like big body of work was with teens and families. And I still do see some teens and families, but not as many as I used to.
Going in that direction, I was wondering if you ever found it helpful to align with parents about your experience so that maybe it gave you some more clout, or maybe they listened more because they're saying, well, gosh, she recovered. Maybe she really does know what she's talking about. Because I think certainly in our field, a lot of the things we say go counter to what is out there, you know, in the world in terms of food. Mm-hmm. And certainly it's against a lot of the things that are in the medical field. And I've found a lot of people go to their medical doctors first or nurse practitioners when they struggle with eating disorders. And the information they're given there is very sometimes counter to what we tell them, right? So,
sure.
And especially in the diet culture we're in, there's a lot of messaging about foods and things like that. And parents themselves may be eating in a certain way that's detrimental to the child you're working with. And so I was just wondering if it's ever helped you align with them and say, hey, I've recovered, just so maybe they can be more open to changing some things in the home.
I definitely, again, if anybody makes an appointment on my website, which that's how it's done these days, they'll see that I have a recovery history if they read anything in my about section. Mm-hmm. And I do think sharing that experience is in there has been helpful to families that I work with. I also think that disclosing that I'm a parent has been extremely helpful too. I think when I was a young clinician and didn't have the experience of parenting, I didn't have as much empathy for parents as I do now. Because I get it. It's really hard to navigate this world and diet culture with kids, even as a professional who kind of knows better and knows what to say and knows roughly like how to proceed with food and discussion of bodies. It doesn't matter. It's one of the things I wrote about in my latest book. Like sometimes we make mistakes or we say the wrong thing because we're just part of this soup that we're swimming in of diet culture. So I think having like being a parent now, I have a lot of empathy and compassion for how hard it is to raise kids in this culture and raise kids to feel comfortable in their bodies.
Let's talk about that. Let's kind of delve into that.
Sure.
Because I think it is hard. I'm a parent too, teenagers, and I can't even imagine being a teenager right now living with the phones and social media. I can't even imagine all the influences they have just from that. But let's talk about some of the things that maybe you said, oh, I've kind of fallen prey to maybe saying some things, or it's hard for me. What do you personally find that it's a struggle even for you being in this field?
Yeah. And so I have two daughters who are now in college, and I've always raised them to be really flexible and neutral around food and very open to diverse body types. And as I mentioned in my book, there was a time when I made, for example, a disparaging remark about my body. I said something about my chest, and my daughter came back to me at age 15 and said, "Mom, we are both in the itty bitty titty committee. Own it." So there was a way in which, like, she called me out on my sort of body language that wasn't so kind. And that's the kind of thing that, like, it's so easy to do. Even if you do mostly feel like you've done tons of recovery work and you feel comfortable in your body, it's hard not to be in this culture and occasionally say something negative out loud. And I was, like, so appreciative that she kind of called me out on it. And then we had a laugh about it. But that's, like, an example. Or when it comes to food, and I'm a nutrition therapist who works on this topic all the time, but it was hard for me to not want to push my kids to eat their breakfast as they left the house, even though I know that in doing that, I'm, like, stepping over into their lane and maybe not helping them to self-regulate themselves. But, like, knowing what I know as a nutritionist, I am knowing, like, that they needed fuel for school. Like, it was hard for me not to get into lecture mode and to let them kind of make those choices for themselves. So those are a couple examples where even if you know better, it's so easy to create a message that is maybe not what you're wanting to create around food or bodies. And the key is to just catch it and correct it.
So I often hear this from parents. They're so worried. They're so concerned. My kid's not eating enough. They're not eating the right things. So I'm assuming you hear that a lot from parents too. There's concern that, yeah, they're not eating breakfast or they're not eating enough of the quote unquote, whatever foods they think they need for growth or whatnot. And certainly a lot of concern what I hear parents talk about younger kids. Oh my gosh, all they want to eat is, like, orange foods, right? Whatever. And just so concerned and thinking I have to push this on them or I'm not doing the right thing. They're going to get sick. Do you have thoughts on these kinds of things?
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts. That's why I wrote a book.
Which I love. But,
first and foremost, like, I think that, like, children need less information about nutrition and more just ease and calm and connection around food in the house. And so I think when parents get worried about the quantity of food that their kids are eating or the quality of food that they're eating, it takes away from that sort of easeful, peaceful experience of having a meal together. Or maybe it is just running out the door and having something to eat on the way to school, because that's the reality of our lives. But I think that worry about our kids' food intake is mostly unwarranted, because children do naturally, with very little guidance, and there has to be a little structure around meals and snacks. And obviously what we bring into our house has lots of different, we want to have balance and diversity in our houses in terms of food. But other than that, like, children do a really good job of selecting the foods that are best for them and eating a very balanced diet over the course of a week. Like, maybe on one day, it's not going to be so great. But for the most part, children do pretty well. It's when we interfere and we start calling some foods bad or good that children get very confused. And then they wonder, like, well, why is it that this food that I really like that feels good in my body, everybody's saying is bad? Like, it just gets confusing for kids. And then they start to not have such good self-regulation because they're thinking about what they're eating instead of feeling into their appetite more, if that makes sense.
You say, if we could just abolish the good food, bad food, healthy, unhealthy, junk food, all these labels, right? Because I think, to your point, a lot of the quote unquote good foods and bad foods, like the quote unquote bad foods taste good. So that's confusing. But then they're told it's bad to eat those. And so, and a lot of fear about those foods, right?
Right.
They become what I call the fear foods later on. It's, these foods are bad for me. They're going to cause all these problems, are going to cause me to gain weight, they're going to cause all this bad stuff, so I've got to stay away from them, which,
right,
that's a whole problem in and of itself.
And sometimes it also makes them more attractive, right?
Right.
On the flip side, it can cause them to have more charge too. Oh, everyone says I shouldn't be eating this, so maybe I have to sneak it, and then it gets a little bit more power. So it can go either way.
And I'm curious, because I mean, you work in the food realm, I work in the therapy realm, right? So mm-hmm. like, when, what are you seeing in terms of trends with parents? And there's so much, I think I call it misinformation out there about food. What is the best way, quote unquote, best way to eat? It's constantly changing. But I think there's a lot of, oh, don't eat this, don't eat that. Even there's books, right? Eat this, not that.
Right, right. And there's a lot of focus on clean eating these days, which like doesn't sound like dieting, but it really sort of is in disguise. This idea of something's clean and something's not clean is still good and bad labeling. It sort of looks like we're trying to create health. And I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to create health in your kitchen and bring healthy, balanced, diverse food into your kitchen. But focusing so much on that at the expense of pleasure and enjoyment and connection, because really eating together as a family, I think just that act itself is so much more valuable than what you serve. And I'm saying that as a nutritionist too. I do think that, yes, it's like food is meaningful and food is helpful to our bodies, but ultimately it's about the attitude around food that is so much more important than actually what's served.
Right. I want to go back to what you said too. So when there's households that restrict lots of things, like certain food groups or sugars or whatever, I have my experience with what that looks like over time. But you know, you brought up that they're sneaking the food. It becomes more something they're wanting. But how do you work with families where they're just like adamant, like, this is not coming to the house? They really believe that it's toxic. They really believe it's bad. How do you work with that?
Yeah, I mean, I usually tell it straight to the parents. And I say, the only kids who used to climb up to the top cabinet to find all of the Halloween candy that was just getting dusty in our house were the kids who came from sugar-free households. That by making sugar, quote unquote, toxic, you're really just creating a kid who goes to their friend's house and looks for all the sweets that happen to be there and maybe are eaten moderately. So I do tell it straight. I'm not saying that means parents can't have some reasonable limits around, let's take sugar, for instance. Maybe you wouldn't send a kid into a candy store and say you can eat anything you want, but you would set some limits and say, here's a bag and you can fill it up, or here's a couple of dollars. This is what you can spend in the store. So it's okay to have some limits, especially if you have a kid who already has shown signs of eating a food out of moderation, which is easy to do in this culture. But for the most part, having too rigid limits around food groups just makes that food group more problematic for the young person. So I usually just tell it straight to families and say, I think that's going to create more problems than benefit for your kids by having sugar be off limits, for example.
So like kind of flipping up to the 180, what about parents who are so concerned saying, I don't think my kid's eating enough. They refuse to eat. Or I think they come to the dinner table like, oh, I ate so much today. I'm not hungry. How do you know if you should be concerned or not? Like, how do you know if your kid actually did eat enough and like be forcing them to eat dinner, but you're really thinking maybe they didn't. So for parents who are maybe in that boat thinking, I don't want to be a helicopter and monitor them, but I really don't think they're eating enough.
Yeah. And no, I think that it's important for parents to talk to their young person if they think that perhaps they aren't eating enough. It could simply be because they've got so much other things going on. Mm-hmm. For example, the social stuff at school is way more important to the kid than sitting and eating lunch, or they get distracted easily and therefore food kind of takes a back seat. So I think I always tell parents that kids are like we all are sort of like on a continuum, and on this end are like the foodies, where food is like a real strong sensory experience and they love food and they relish all the tastes and textures and and are into it. And then there's the kids who are like really totalitarian about it, and adults who just don't want, they could eat the same thing every day and they don't really care. And most of us are somewhere in between those two extremes. So it may be that this child is just more interested in other things than food and does need a little bit more direction and like motivation to sit down and eat. And that's where having a parent who maybe sits with them and has a snack with them after school would be helpful, or checking in with them around how are they eating. And if there's concern with their, they can always check to see, are they growing? Most of the time, these fears are like not founded, that the child is growing. They are eating. Maybe they're going through a period where they're eating a little bit less, but they'll probably make up for it on the other end of a growth spurt. But for the most part, I think it's just good to stay curious and engaged around either extreme. If you think your child is eating a little too much or a little bit too little, and again, even those terms, I don't like to say them, but there might be something else going on. And I think just staying engaged with the child is important.
What do you typically see? Like who comes in your office? Like who comes to see? Who makes the appointment online?
Well, I mean, if it's an adult, it's just the adult or the college student who makes the appointment. But if it's a teen, it would be the parent who makes the appointment. And if it's a young teen, then I'm going to be working with the parents a lot. If it's someone who's like an older teen, like 16, 17, I might work more with the young person because they're starting to get more independent in their feeding. But then obviously checking in with parents here and there with that young person's, usually with the young person in the room too, so that I'm not going to lose connection with that person too.
What are they, maybe there's not like one typical thing people are coming in for, but are there like more prevalent issues that they're asking for help with, or what's coming in?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a family looking for support around disordered eating, mm-hmm. maybe the young person just came out of a treatment program and they're setting up outpatient providers. Maybe they're coming in because they're concerned that the young person has started to eat less or work out more, and they want them to have a nutritionist to talk to. They don't want to be the one being the food police at home. And, or sometimes it's a parent who's concerned about their young person's weight and they want to meet with a nutritionist to help to quote unquote fix that. And in that case, I would talk more directly with parents without the young person present about shifting the focus, not to weight, but to just nourishing the body well, taking good care of the body. And sometimes I might just clear, especially if it's a young child, I would just work with the parents. I don't work with any kids with an eating disorder below age like 12. If someone's coming in under age 12, I'm just going to talk with the parents because I don't want to create more attention around food than there already is with a young child.
So maybe for people listening, and maybe they have a young child, why would that be? Like, what would be the purpose of only working with the parents? Yeah, I know you said to take the attention off, but
yeah,
how do you think that would create more attention for the child?
Yeah, I think it's trying to create an atmosphere in the home where food is neutral, where there's openness about different body types. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we all as adults have to work on our own internalized fat phobia. And I think it's best to talk about that when the child's not present. I think it's best to talk about, sometimes parents need some direction in terms of how much to talk about food in the house. And again, there may be already so much discussion about food that I want to decrease the emphasis on it. So working with parents around that is usually helpful.
So some things I get asked a lot are, well, my kid's getting bullied, and so they need to lose weight because this is the issue, or their medical doctor told them they, with these new pediatric guidelines, they were told my child needs to lose weight because they're going to get sick or they can't have that. And so there's this pressure on parents to change something. And I know part of the protocol is to send them to a dietitian or nutritionist if they reach certain criteria. So, I mean, that scares me because if they're not seeing a specialist like yourself, a lot of damage could be done by this messaging. But I just like to know kind of your thoughts on that, because I know there is a lot of pressure in our culture to look a certain way or not have a certain body type, that if you have a certain body type, then the message is you're not healthy.
Right. And it's unfortunate that's out there. And sometimes families come in and the damage has already been done by another health professional, like you said. But I think parents can go a long way towards being like changing a culture in the house and changing the culture among their group of friends, so that there is less of an emphasis on a certain body type is better than another. So I'm happy when parents come in and want to talk about that. If they say, I see that my daughter is getting teased and I really don't want her to be teased. What I wish everyone would say, every health professional would say, is that dieting or doing some restrictive eating is not the way to fix that problem. That bullying has to be addressed, obviously, in a different way with the family. Most of what I read about when I was doing research for my book, Nurture, is that I think the research indicates that kids who are bullied, even those that are bullied because of their body size, want to know that their families have their back. And that's the most important thing. So if we can just let go of the emphasis on food and bodies and body shape and just say, okay, this young person is hurting, kids are being cruel, I need to bring myself in a little bit more and support this young person and remind them that although kids can be cruel, that there's absolutely nothing wrong with their body. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with who they are as a person. And that to me, that's the most important message. And if we could all, as health professionals, help families with that, would be wonderful.
Yeah, because I think you're right. The message becomes, okay, we're going to fix this so that you can't get bullied anymore. And I love what you just said. It's, wait a minute. Hold on here. There's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with our society that people have this idea that this is wrong and they can bully somebody. I think that's the bigger issue, that unfortunately there's a lot of work to be done.
Bigger issue.
That's a whole big issue, right? But yeah, to your point, I mean, kids get bullied for all sorts of reasons, not just for that. But of course, it's got to be devastating for a child to be bullied and then to be told like, oh, we got to fix you. And then if their body doesn't change, what happens?
Right. I mean, I thought about it when I talked to one parent not long ago, actually, about this. And I said, when I was 6 years old, I was bullied because I had glasses. Mm-hmm. And like that, like I wasn't going to say, okay, now I have to fix my eyes so that I can see. It's just interesting that we go to, okay, I have to move my child's body to this ideal in order for them to not be punished. No, I think we as parents and as greater neighborhood cultures, we need to make it safe for kids to be in all different body sizes. And we can teach that to kids. I believe that we can teach that to kids. I do think that we're swimming upstream sometimes against a culture that's not kind and against even our own biases that the media places on us right away. If you look at children's programming and movies, the villains are often in larger bodies than the heroes and the heroines. So I think it's a bigger cultural issue, but I think parents can go a long way to explaining that to kids when they're old enough to understand it and to really enforce that we don't prefer one body type over another.
No, I love that. I'm glad you brought that up or said that, because I hear that so many times. And then also linked to that is I'm worried if as a parent, I'm not doing something right. Not only are they getting bullied, but now I'm being told they're going to be unhealthy or I need to do something. So please, Heidi, fix this, right? Like they might be coming to you just out of desperation.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be hard to hear that, like, the answer is not to change the way everybody eats, but actually to just keep the environment around the child really, like, connected and, and to really support this young person as they go through the bumpiness of growth. Right. But I think it's fun to talk with families and to see them have those aha moments that, like, of course they love their child no matter their size. And just like they love their children who have different hair colors, they love their, but I think to be able to just create a different culture in the household is so, so important. And it's not usually about food. I mean, yes, I believe in feeding kids well and balanced and making sure good food is available on the regular and having a little structure around that, especially for kids who might be neurodivergent, for example, and need a little bit more structure so they can sit down and attend to a meal. But the reality is kids don't need so much nutrition education, actually, for specifically from their parents.
I can imagine somebody listening saying, yeah, exactly. What's the good food? What is that? I don't know, right? I think that's where people get tripped up is like, there's so many definitions of what that is in different households and different, you can go online and you drive yourself batty. Just like.
Right. And I have a chapter in my book about nutrition, or we also talk a lot about pleasure in it, but I think nutrition, I'll tell you what my rule of thumb for a balanced meal is for parents. This is what I tell parents. There's five elements. There's some kind of carbohydrate or grain food. There's some kind of protein. There's some kind of fat. There's some produce. And there's pleasure. And if you hit most of those, you're doing pretty well. And you don't have to hit all of them. But for the most part, that creates a balanced meal. And a snack might be two of those elements. That's my basic lesson about nutrition that I think parents and families need to hear.
The pleasure part, I think, gets dismissed a lot, or it's indulgent, or it's treat, or it's earned, or whatever it is, like guilt, shame, all sorts of things. So just to normalize it, I think, is very helpful.
Yeah, food should be delicious and fun. And that, whether it's dessert or it's the main entree, like it should be enjoyed and fun. And I encourage parents to cook with their kids, to teach their kids about how to make food and make it like a family activity at times, so that kids actually learn about how food gets put together. And then they're not like floundering when they're on their own. All my grad students, they like finally stop being fed by a cafeteria and they're like, I don't know what to do.
But it's interesting. I found that too. Like when I work with families and the kids start cooking with their parents and they are so excited that they created something. They're like so excited to present it to the family and eat it. They're like, look what I made. And it's, I think there's some excitement there too. So just the act of doing that can open up their minds to things and get them maybe excited about food in a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. Most garden variety pickiness gets grown out of. I think that when it becomes more problematic is when it becomes a power struggle, because parents are really anxious about it and the kids understand, oh, I can really exert my power by refusing to eat something. So I do think, I mean, obviously there's ARFID and there's sensory issues, you know, that happen that involve food. But for the most part, we don't need to get too excited about picky eating. It like it comes and goes. And most of those young people who are picky become adults who eat a much more wide variety over time, as long as things are continued to be exposed to them. Ideally in a really neutral way. Would this be a night that you feel like trying this? Yeah. Would this be a night that you feel like trying this food that you tried last time and didn't like? And if the kid says no, pick your battles, but just be really neutral about it and just keep bringing those foods onto the table. And eventually, usually most pickiness gets grown out of if it's fairly neutral in the house.
So, I mean, there's lots of approaches, right? And so if anyone's listening, they're like, well, shouldn't I ask, just take 3 bites or just try a bite? I love your approach. It's just kind of very neutral, very benign, just kind of in a conversation. But parents think, well, if I don't say that, they're never going to try it. Just try 2 bites. Just try a bite.
Yeah. And I'm not a big fan of trying to coerce children to eat something or not eat something, mm-hmm. doing a dance or doing any of those things that we might do. Although I have to admit that there are times when I did it too. So I'm just going to own that it's hard not to do that when you're a parent and you want your kids to eat the food that you work so hard to prepare or you work so hard to put on the table. Just from a financial standpoint, it can be frustrating when kids don't eat. But I do think that we step into their, like I mentioned, Ellen Satter earlier, she talks about that division of responsibility as a parent. Our responsibility is to make food available in a diverse array of ways. And the children's responsibility is to eat it and decide how much to eat it. And when we start to say 3 more bites, we kind of step over into their zone of responsibility. And I don't think it hurts here and there, but I think repeatedly it can create some confusion for a young person who's really just trying to listen to their own body's self-regulation, as opposed to somebody else who's saying, you should eat this or you shouldn't eat this. Like, the goal is to have kids grow up to be someone who can, kids grow up to be people who can self-regulate and make those decisions for themselves. And if we step in there, we interfere with that process. And again, you can very neutrally ask, would this be a night to try a new green food? And again, if the child puts their arms together and says, and puts their feet on the floor and says, no, then I would pick your battles and not get into a power struggle about it. But I think making a gentle suggestion, always exposing, saying, I didn't like broccoli either, but when I tried it with some cheese, it was delicious. Would you like to try it that way? Again, making it fun and neutral can be helpful.
Anytime, but I wanted to tackle one more thing that comes up often, which is kind of earning the pleasure foods, as you talk about. And I guess a lot of families call it like dessert food, eating to earn it. Okay, you have to have the quote unquote dinner food or good food, and then you can have that. But if you don't, then you don't get it. And you brought up for children to learn to regulate and to be in tune with their own hunger signals. And I always thought, gosh, by the time they get to eating the whatever it is that they maybe are craving or wanting or feel as a treat or earning, whatever that becomes, right? Oh, they want the ice cream. They're full or they're no longer hungry, but they've been kind of put in this position of, oh, I had to eat like my salad and my broccoli or whatever. I had to eat this dinner. I had to eat through that to get this, but, you know, or, oh, you didn't eat that. Now you can't have that.
Sure. Well, I'm not a fan of ever like having food be something that you have to earn. Mm-hmm. And I'm like definitely not a fan of this idea that, well, after you do a certain amount of physical activity, then you can eat. I don't like to use that language in front of children. I think it creates a toxic relationship with fitness too. But that's a whole, we could talk about that.
Oh, we could have other a whole hours. Other session, a whole other podcast.
That was a whole other chapter too. But honestly, I did something like a little non-traditional in my house, and I have recommended it to families, and it's been helpful for some families. Has it worked for everyone? But I always put dessert on the table at the same time as everything else. And I know that's going to be controversial in a lot of people. It's probably going to blow several people's minds, but everything was sort of family style on my table, and people could choose what they wanted of the different items on the table. And yes, there were some days that my kids chose a fair amount of the dessert kind of food, but most of the time not. It was super neutral. Sometimes we had a dessert type food and sometimes we didn't. It wasn't like a consistent all the time, every time thing. So I just, again, made it very neutral in my house, and that worked pretty well in my household. It may not work for other households, especially if you've been doing things another way for a while and your kids already have this idea that they have to wait for dessert or earn dessert. But in order to change that dynamic, you could try it and just see, we're going to do an experiment. I often tell families that, like, make it fun and say, we're going to try an experiment. And sometimes when you do an experiment, things don't work. And like all of a sudden everybody's not eating as well-rounded as they used to eat. So this isn't working. So then everybody kind of gets together and talks about, okay, how can we make this work better? But I agree. I think our idea that we have to fill up on all kinds of food in order to earn a dessert just makes that food more powerful. Actually, it makes it more attractive than it really is. What I want to do is have kids be able to self-select whether or not they feel ready for dessert or not. Okay, today I feel like having dessert. Today I'm really full from dinner because dinner was so good. I have no room for dessert, and just be able to make that choice. But they can't do that if there's like a regimen around it that says certain things have to be eaten before.
I love that. And just on that, I'm sharing this like through my own treatment. That was one thing that helped me get through, was just putting all the foods in like my meals, including like the foods that I personally thought were like fear foods, or I had categorized as like the foods I had to earn. And when I did that, it was like this game changer. It was just like completely helped me get rid of all the labels of food, and just, it took away, to your point, the power of it, right?
Right.
Yeah, maybe I want it. Maybe I don't. Maybe I'll have a bite of this. Maybe I'll have a bite. But I got to self-regulate and like really realize like sometimes I ate everything that was on my plate. Sometimes I didn't. But it was really interesting to be able to learn to tune in with my body and what I craved and what I wanted that day. And it took away all of that. So just sharing that for anyone listening.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people might hear my suggestion and say, oh, my kids would never do that. They just eat all the cookies. But they may be inclined to do that because the cookies have become loaded in some way.
Right.
And it's not the parents' fault. It's like our communities too. Like people at the after school programs and the sports teams and stuff make a big deal about treats too. Some of it is just like how we're culturally set up to view certain foods over other foods. But I do think the home culture can change things a little bit. And I appreciate you sharing that piece about your own recovery, because I do think neutrality is really where it's at when it comes to food. And people don't believe that their kids can be neutral about it. But over time, they can be. And it starts with the parents being really neutral about it. The caregivers too. Like you might talk to grandparents and after school programs and about, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying not to label foods this way. Would you be willing to join me on this pursuit?
Yeah. And to your point, like initially, the first few days, the kids might be like, wow, right? And that's all they, and the parents are like, oh my gosh, it doesn't work. But to your point, give it some time.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter. Actually, I often did it as a reading at my book tour events, mm-hmm. Like the Pop-Tart chapter, because I didn't like really expose my kids to Pop-Tarts because mm-hmm. I thought they tasted like cardboard, but they discovered them at age 16 and kind of had a little Pop-Tart binge fest for a little mm-hmm. while, because they were like, where have you been all my life? And I wrote about this in a humorous way, but it wore off. Like after a couple of months, they were like done with all the flavors. But, you know, I think that's how it is. Anytime we're trying to shift our perspective about a food that's been restrictive or a whole food group that's been restrictive, the pendulum is going to swing towards overdoing it. And that happens a lot in eating disorder recovery too. Certainly was a part of my recovery too. And the key is to just let that rebound ride out until you can get to that middle ground where Pop-Tarts are just like everything else.
So you mentioned a couple books, and obviously, I mean, there's a lot of great information in there just from what you've shared today. How do people find the books? How do they find you? How can they work with you? Tell us all the information about you.
Yeah, thank you. So, well, I think you're going to put in the show notes links to my website. My books are on my website. The first one is Nourish, How to Heal Your Relationship with Food, Body, and Self. Nice. I wrote that in 2018, and I'm working on an update at the moment. And Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves, just came out this past year. And my website is anourishingword.com. So you can find them there, and you can find them in all the places. You ask bookstores to get them for you, and you can find them at all the online book outlets that are there.
Well, you have been amazing. Thank you for all of this information. Like I said, we could probably have 10 podcasts. So,
yeah, we could. I don't know, Christina. I think we could talk for another couple hours about this and more. So, but thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So everyone go to her website, get her books. Again, Heidi, thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation. Thank you.